You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 156, Ezekiel, chapters 40 through 48, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good. Another busy week, but I think pretty productive.
Yeah, we're good. You did an awesome job on the Jim Baker show.
Yeah, it was fun. You know, like I blogged about it. And, you know, if anybody has any questions about, you know, hey, what in the world is Mike doing on this show? Go to drmsh.com. I blogged a few thoughts on it. You know, the bottom line is that, you know, we all know that he's not a theologian. And the good news is that he didn't pretend to be. You know, was very upfront about that, but he made the effort. He, you know, he is interested in the content. He's interested in having his audience hear the content. And so that's good. That's a good thing, because if any audience out there in the world of, you know, Christianity or Christian Middle Earth needs this content, especially as it comes, as it relates to the spirit world, it's this bunch. Okay. They need it. And they're not going to come to me, so I need to go to them. And it was a positive experience across the board. You know, he just made the effort, so I'm grateful for that.
Absolutely, you could not have articulated the message better. I think the people who need to hear it will hear it, and hopefully they'll become Naked Bible Podcast listeners and go from there and learn.
You have to think it would help. You know,
absolutely.
You're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. Absolutely. So you can't be part of the solution if you don't show up.
Absolutely. So, Mike, we've winding down Ezekiel. We only have two more episodes. So what are you going to do?
Can you believe it? Can we stretch it into five or six?
Technically, right? Yeah, it should be another eight or nine. So how are you going to do this?
Well, you know, chapters 40 through 48, you know, we're going to do this in two parts. And, you know, we'll just jump in here. I mean, these chapters are divisible into three sections. So you have three whole chapters, you know, basically 40 to into 43, describing the vision of the future temple. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and just read through all that. And, oh, well, this is what a corner means. This is what a measuring reed is. You know, okay, we don't need to do that. But again, it's important to say something about it. And we're going to do that in this episode. Then you get chapters 40 through 44 through 46. That those are rules governing going into the temple and coming back out. Okay, again, that's not terribly exciting, so that's not going to get its own episode. And then 47 and 48, you have the allotment or the apportionment of the future land among the people of Israel. Okay, so that has sort of this Joshua feel to it. But again, none of this material is really going to lend itself to, you know, something super revelatory at the granular level. Okay, and that's the key thought here. If you take these chapters as a whole, there are some things that are not only worth thinking about, but that are really important to think about when it comes to, okay, what does this mean? Not only, again, for its original hearers, but something toward the future, something beyond Ezekiel's own day. And of course, right away, there's the big issue of, you know, should we understand this description literally? Is this like going to be a temple in the future millennial kingdom and all these sorts of questions? So on a macro level, you know, taking these chapters as a whole, there's a lot of interesting stuff here that needs to get talked about. And so that's how we're going to approach it. Now, if you're interested, I'm going to send Trey a diagram, basically pictures that come from blocks, Nicott commentary on Ezekiel, the second volume, of what the structure would look like, you know, that sort of thing. So you'll be able to look at that, but we're not going to go to the granular level here and talk about, well, hey, look, how is this vestibule different from the other one over here? We're not going to do that. But if you want to know, again, a sort of a visualization of this content, you know, we'll make that available. Today, we're really going to talk about two issues related to Ezekiel 40 through 48. The first one is the question of whether we are to understand this vision as a future literal building. In other words, this idea of a temple in the millennial period being a physical structure that is built either before or in conjunction with the second coming of Christ? In other words, is this about a building that's going to be in operation after the second coming? Okay, that's one issue. The second is the matter of the nasi, which is a Hebrew term for prince in these chapters. Now, the first part, people, you know, the quote, prophecy experts, unquote, you know, they're all over the whole building thing, you know, for, you know, right or wrong. The talk about the prince, though, I think gets neglected and is going to influence, I think, ultimately the way we need to look at these chapters. So we're going to discuss those two matters as they pertain to this whole collective, Ezekiel 40 through 48. So let's start with the first issue. Are we to understand this vision of Ezekiel as a future literal building, i.e., a temple, another temple that is in operation after the second coming of Christ? Now, I'm predisposed to answer this question, no. It's not about a literal building for three broad reasons. And here they are. We're gonna drill down into all of these things, but here are my three reasons in a nutshell. Number one, you know about my view that the future earthly kingdom is the new earth, not a 1,000-year interregnum before the new earth. We talked about that in the last podcast that we did on Ezekiel 38 and 39. So when people ask me if I believe in a coming earthly kingdom of God with the returned Messiah, Jesus, as its king, my answer is yes. I believe the kingdom will come to earth. But I don't mean the standard millennium idea when I say that. So, you know, it's this length issue. It's this number issue. But again, if that's unfamiliar to you, listen to the last podcast, part two of Ezekiel 38 and 39, and you'll understand what I'm talking about there and why. Secondly, I think we have to say that this isn't about a future literal building because of the negative arguments against literalism here. That is, features of the text that suggest that what's being described transcends literalism. In other words, there are textual indications that don't seem to jive with literal expectation that Ezekiel 40 through 48 is really about giving instructions for building this temple that's in operation after the second coming. Thirdly, there are positive arguments for seeing the description in Ezekiel 40 through 48 as pointing to a reality that transcends a physical building. So there are arguments against it from the text, and there are arguments against a literal approach in the text, and there are arguments for a more than literal approach. Now, the third one of those, the positive arguments about seeing the description as pointing to some reality that transcends a physical building, that's really going to be where we land in part two. Okay, so next episode, part two of Ezekiel 40 through 48, we're going to really focus on that third element, the positive arguments for seeing the description as something that transcends the idea of a literal building. So for today, again, we're going to park in the other things. So let's focus on my second reason. We're not going to go back and talk about Ezekiel 30 and 38 and all that sort of stuff about new earth is the kingdom and as opposed to a 1,000-year millennial reign, you know, how to 6 of 1 and a half dozen other. We're not going to go repeat that. So what we're really going to focus on here are the negative arguments that arise from the text against taking this description as a building project in the future, you know, about building a structure in the future. So within that category, again, negative arguments, let's just list out a few. I'll use letter numbers here because I use numbers above. So the first one, letter A, if you're taking notes here, there are disconnections with other Old Testament passages about building the tabernacle and the temple in earlier contexts. There are disconnections with those descriptions and this one in Ezekiel 40 through 48. Now, in his article, there's an article by Moshe Greenberg entitled The Design and Themes of Israel's Program or Restoration. He notes the following. He talks about the fact that there are instructions for making the desert tabernacle in Exodus 25 through 30. There's a narrative describing its building, the actual building of that structure in Exodus 35 through 40. There's also a narrative description of the building of Solomon's temple in 1 Kings 6. None of these other passages that describe how to build and the building of these other structures. None of them are really similar to what we have in Ezekiel 40 through 42, when we actually get the description of the temple. In fact, Ezekiel 40 through 42 is actually not a set of instructions for building anything. It's a vision of something that's already built. Okay, that it's a vision of something that exists. There are no building instructions in Ezekiel 40 through 48, and specifically chapters 40 through 42. Taylor, you know, who we've mentioned on other episodes of Ezekiel, this is not from his commentary. This is from an essay called "The Temple in Ezekiel" in a book called "Heaven on Earth," just about temple stuff, tabernacle stuff throughout the Bible. He writes this: the first thing to note is that there is no indication in Ezekiel that the construction of such a city and such a temple was authorized by God. As Allen, another scholar, observes, significantly, there is no call to rebuild the temple, only to observe the regulations for rites and offerings. The new temple was to be Yahweh's creation, built for, rather than by, his people. It's a model of his own being and of his relationship with them. Unquote. Back to Taylor. Instead, Ezekiel is presented with a scenario prepared by God, which he is shown around by his interpreting angel guide. The new temple is God's doing. The prophet's only task is to describe it in full detail as he can. In other words, there's no command in these chapters to build anything. The prophet just sees this thing that God says, hey, go look at that, and then describe it. And he does. So that's a disconnect, because when you have the descriptions of the tabernacle and the temple in other parts of the Old Testament, there are very clear building plans there, very clear things that people are supposed to do to create this structure. You don't get that in Ezekiel 40 through 48. So that is a very obvious, at least to a close reader, it's a very obvious outlier. It's something that you'd expect that is missing. Secondly, or letter B, again, if you're taking notes, there are irregularities in the architecture and the furniture of what Ezekiel describes in chapters 40 through 48. Again, things that you'd expect to see, and they're either not there or there's something odd about them. First example, under, again, letter B, if you're taking notes. There's an absence, curiously enough, of height dimension in nearly all of the descriptions. In fact, height, again, the Hebrew term for height, is actually mentioned only two times. One is in Ezekiel 40, verse 5, where it alludes to a wall, and the other one is Ezekiel 43:13, where it describes the height of the altar. Now, Greenberg comments on this on page 193 of his article. He says, there are some notable omissions. With very few exceptions, measurements are of length and breadth only. In other words, the visionary has effectively conveyed only a ground plan, bounding and describing areas in accord with his basic concern over separation and gradation of sacred space. Unquote. Now, at another point, Greenberg says this, a word on the precision and detail argument, again, is affected by this. Again, just to summarize, you know, what Greenberg is thinking, how can you say something is really precise? In other words, how can you say God is giving a detailed plan that he wants people to follow to construct this building, this object, if he never throws in how high things are supposed to be, how tall things are supposed to be? What would you do? What would you do as a contractor? Two out of three dimensions here are there, but the third one isn't, and it's kind of important. And not only that, but there's never any clear description of a roof, you know, for the temple. Which is really odd. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, kind of silly about it, but we really don't want birds pooping on sacred space. I mean, this is why buildings have roofs, you know, especially if they're holy buildings. And you just don't have this. Now, I think this is noteworthy because one of the things you run into all the time in defense of the, this must be about a literal structure that's going to be, you know, rebuilt or built after, before, shortly before, whatever, you know, sometime, you know, to be used by the Messiah. After he returns, is this so-called detail argument. And I just want to throw in a few thoughts here, my own two cents here. I don't think the detail argument makes much sense just generally, and here's why. Think about the logic. the more detail something receives, that means we're supposed to take the passage literally. Well, if that's the case, what does that say about the meaning of prophecies that have less detail? Should we take them non-literally then? There are plenty of Old Testament prophecies about Messiah, again, that lack detail. And in some cases, they're kind of ambiguous. The fact that something is laid out in detail is not an argument against its symbolic meaning later on, either within the Old Testament or how the New Testament repurposes something. Just by way of illustration, Passover is laid out in great detail, actually two different chapters in the Old Testament, but it's considered a type. It's considered to, you know, symbolic. It's a type of the sacrifice on the cross later on. And the crucifixion, when you read the crucifixion accounts, it doesn't mime the steps of the Passover. It doesn't do that at all. But there's a very secure relationship between the two. The equation is made by New Testament authors, nevertheless. So there you have a case where something's very detailed and you're not supposed to interpret it literally, because the crucifixion doesn't mimic what happens in the Passover, even though there's a very clear conceptual relationship between the two. So you got, in essence, detail is not a hermeneutic. Detail, the fact that something is detailed, doesn't tell you how it should be interpreted. The fact that it's not detailed doesn't tell you how it should be interpreted. The issue is, again, context or contexts. And one of the contexts that's important that I think gets neglected is how the New Testament repurposes ideas. You know that if you listen to this podcast just in general, I'm kind of big on this notion that the New Testament is an inspired commentary in the Old Testament. So what the New Testament says about the Old Testament ought to matter. And I think this is a case too. Now, we're going to get into more of that in part two, because the New Testament does have a lot of temple talk in it. And there is no prophecy in the New Testament, about the expectation that a new temple will be built. There just isn't. Amid all of its temple talk, okay, you're not going to find that. And of course, the defenders of a literal approach here would say, well, who cares? You know, we have Ezekiel 40 through 48. Look at all that detail. Well, again, does that tell us how to interpret anything? And is it really that detailed? Because it doesn't have any height, doesn't have a roof. So what counts as detail? What counts as precision? And I hope you get the idea that there are disconnections here. Another one. Again, this is all under, again, what would be our letter B. So we have these irregularities in architecture and the furniture. So the first one was the height dimension is not there. Second, there are some issues of disproportion and, again, you know, omission as well. Greenberg says, he notes, the massive size of the gatehouses verges on caricature. Their dimensions, which are 20, 25 by 50 cubits, exceed those of the main hall of the temple itself, 20 by 40 cubits. Their length is half that of the inner court, 100 cubits. In other words, if you actually built this, it's going to look kind of odd. It's going to be pretty disproportionate. He also notes that many furnishings of the Solomonic temple and the desert tabernacle are missing in this description. For example, the ark and its cherubs and the lamp are not there. The only interior furniture mentioned is an ambiguous, quote, altar of wood, unquote. Greenberg adds, it's very strange is the absence of a wall around the inner court, to which its three massive gates might stand in relation. No equivalent, in addition to the lavers or the bronze sea, appears in the outer court. Where were the priests supposed to wash? The notion that the water issuing from the temple might serve for that purpose is unlikely, for until it leaves the temple, it's too thin a stream for body washing. And end of quote for Greenberg. So again, he highlights some of these oddities. Important objects of furniture are missing. And of course, if you have a temple and your temple is in operation, then of course, you know, we have the whole issue of sacrifices. Why would the sacrificial system come back? And again, I'll say something about that a little bit later. I don't think it makes any sense that it would come back. But let's just say, okay, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Literalist, okay, you know, it's a real building and now we're going to have sacrifices again. What they don't tell you, you know, they'll come up with all sorts of reasons why this makes sense even after the cross that we have sacrifices again. But what they won't tell you is hey, there's no place for the priest to wash. And that's kind of important for Old Testament ritual. Hey, some of the objects that got sprinkled with blood okay, in the Old Testament aren't even there. Oops. Again, they're just these disconnects. Again, these are disconnections that arise from the text. This isn't Mike saying, "Oh, I just don't like this view, so I'm not going to take it." No, these are problems present in the text, or in some cases they're not in the text. That, you know, those absences create problems for this perspective. Thirdly, again, under the same category here, there's an inconsistency with the boundaries of the promised land. Now, that's going to come later in chapters 47 through 48, as we mentioned at the beginning. The land here that's talked about in Ezekiel is kind of minimalist. In other words, it's the boundaries of the land that are linked to the conquest at a very specific time, you know, under Moses, David, Moses, Joshua, and David. I mean, what about that extra stuff there? Probably saying it a better way, the boundaries here in Ezekiel 47 are roughly those found in the book of Numbers, chapter 34, verses 2 through 12. Again, that excludes, if you actually compare the boundaries here in Ezekiel 47, go back to Numbers 34, here's what's not in the description of the land. It excludes on the north part, again, I'm going to just use Greenberg's summary here, it excludes on the north the Aramean kingdoms conquered by David. Well, if David conquered those kingdoms, why shouldn't they be in the land in the possession of the Israelites later on in this, you know, this eschatological, you know, scene? But it excludes what's conquered by David. On the east, it excludes the Transjordanian domains of the ancient tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half tribe of Manasseh. On the south, it excludes the Edomite territory down to Ezion Geber, which was once part of the kingdom of Judah in the monarchy. So if you're going to interpret this literally, if you're going to interpret Ezekiel 40 through 48 literally, and, oh, this is about a literal building, well, again, look at what the proponents of this view are not telling you. They're not telling you the priests have no place to wash. They're not telling you that important items of furniture to the sacrificial system aren't there. They're not telling you that it doesn't have a height dimension, it doesn't have a roof, that there's disproportion even what is there. And they're also not telling you, hey, if you go actually look at the description of the land here, there's missing land. There's missing land from the monarchy. There's missing land from the days of Moses and Joshua that was conquered and claimed as part of the promised land that it's missing. So how would we legitimize a literal reading of one part of Ezekiel 40 through 48 and kind of let these other ones slide? Okay, I'm suggesting to you that we really can't do that and be consistent. Number four, again, under, you know, what would have been, you know, letter B, the irregularities, if you're taking notes, number four would be, there's no clarity of any command for building anything. I've already mentioned this, but we're putting it under here because I want to read a particular passage. Here's the closest you get to any sort of command about building something, and it really isn't a command to build anything, but the closest you get is Ezekiel 43, verses 10 through 12. I'm going to read those to you. God says, "As for you, son of man, describe to the house of Israel the temple, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and they shall measure the plan. And if they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known to them the design of the temple, its arrangements, its exits, and its entrances. That is, its whole design. And make known to them as well all its statutes and its whole design and all its flaws, or excuse me, all its laws, and write it down in their sight, so that they may observe all its laws and all its statutes and carry them out. This is the law of the temple. The whole territory on the top of the mountain all around shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the temple." Okay, that's the end of verses 10 through 12, Ezekiel 43. The only thing they're commanded to do here is observe the temple laws and its statutes and carry them out. They're never commanded to build anything. Again, if you can read through the entirety of these eight chapters, and you will not find a command to build the thing. That is really odd, to say the least. Now, we've had I'm trying to keep a sense of an outline here because there's just a lot of detail here. Again, we're talking about negative arguments against the literalistic approach to this. A was disconnections with other Old Testament passages about tabernacle and temple building. B was irregularities in the architecture and the furniture. And so we had four things under that. And then C, we have an incoherence, just a general incoherence problem of the return to sacrifice. And I would say, and I'm going to explain what I mean here, even without the atonement issue. Now, those who think the Old Testament sacrifices about atonement mean atonement for sin. In other words, sort of the popular evangelical approach to the Old Testament sacrificial system. People think this is like about, you know, the getting moral forgiveness and having, you know, your sins wiped away as an individual, that sort of thing. In other words, they're superimposing the talk about Jesus onto the Old Testament sacrificial system. If you have listened to our series on Leviticus, you know that that just doesn't work. That's not actually what Leviticus says, you know, 99% of the time. The sacrifices are really about purifying objects and purifying sacred space and that sort of thing. But let's, for the sake of discussion, say that you're one of these people who takes the sacrifice language in the Old Testament as being about personal atonement for sin. Well, if you're taking that perspective, you've got a serious problem. It has to be correct that the sacrifices are not brought back for this purpose. If they are brought back to atone for personal sin, then I don't know any other way to put it, then the writer of Hebrews was just wrong. Because the book of Hebrews makes a big point about how the atoning work of Christ is the key for personal forgiveness, past, present, and future. Look, folks, you and I were born after the cross, okay? And the work of Christ is completely sufficient, completely adequate to take care of our sin problem. So why wouldn't it be completely adequate to take care of some future person's sin problem who's living during a millennium? Okay, if they need the sacrifices, if they need animal sacrifices again, the writer of Hebrews and other passages in the New Testament are simply wrong. They are errant. That is a huge problem. It's a theological problem, to say the least. Now, many in my experience want to affirm a literal temple, but then when you point out the sacrifice problem, they say, okay, well, all right, the sacrifices aren't literal, but the temple still is. Well, let's think about that. If the sacrifices ought not to be considered as literal, why would somebody consider the temple being literal? Who needs a temple with no sacrifices? What's the point to having a temple? If Jesus' sacrifice covered us who lived well after the event, why wouldn't it cover other people who live later in a presumed millennial kingdom? In other words, why would people living in the millennium need animal sacrifice for atonement? Why? The cross atoned for the sins of the world, everyone who ever lived, past, present, and future. So it would naturally include them as well. So what do we need the system for? And if we don't need the system of sacrifices, why do we need a temple? What good is a temple without a sacrificial system? Now, most who would seek to defend sacrifices returning say they will be, you know, some sort of memorial or teaching illustration. In other words, well, the sacrifices will come back to help people in the millennium understand what happened at the cross. Okay, let's think about that because, frankly, it's deeply flawed. Why would people need sacrifices as a reminder of the atonement of Jesus? Why not just hand them a New Testament and have them read about it? Why would anybody need sacrifices for understanding how Jesus fulfilled the point of Old Testament sacrificial stuff when they could just read it like you and I did in the New Testament? Where's the prophecy that says there won't be any New Testaments around in the millennium? Just hand the person a Bible. Hand them a New Testament. Say, well, here's what's going on here. There's the returned Christ. There's the returned Messiah. Hey, if you want to find out what he did in the past on the cross, here, read this. Read this chapter. Why do you need to bring the sacrifices back? Are there no Bibles anymore? Again, it just doesn't make any sense. And with respect to modern Jews, they haven't needed the Old Testament law, quote, commemorated, unquote, to become believers in the Messiah. Since the temple was destroyed 2,000 years ago, Jews have come to Christ just fine for 2,000 years without needing to watch a sacrifice to learn what Jesus did. Again, the whole approach just doesn't make any sense. So I think we have a severe coherence problem. But now let's just say again, we'll try to make it better here. Let's say, okay, you have someone who wants to defend, you know, the literal approach, and they understand that the sacrifices in the Old Testament weren't about individual, you know, sin, moral cleansing, you know, like in other words, we can't impose the talk about Jesus on the Levitical system. And again, if you don't believe that, go listen to the series on Leviticus. Let's just say somebody realizes that, and they say, okay, the sacrifices that are going to come back in the millennium aren't about atoning for sin. they're purification offerings. Okay. They're purification offerings. Well, again, you know, we have an issue there. On the one hand, it's nice to know that you have somebody here who realizes that the Levitical sacrifices were about the purging, or the word we liked when we were doing Leviticus was they were about decontaminating sacred space and sacred objects. Okay, that's good. Okay, but now the point is, well, maybe that this is what we're doing now. When the sacrifices come back, because we have a literal temple and the sacrifices come back, and there's no point to having a temple without sacrifices, but when they come back, it's not about personal atonement. You know, people can get saved just like they do today. It's about cleansing sacred space. It's about, you know, keeping the temple, the new temple, this great millennial temple. It's about keeping that temple pure and decontaminating it, just like it was in Leviticus. Okay, well, I'll ask it again. If this is, you know, your vision, why do we need to revert to purifying sacred space in the millennium when we, as believers, are sacred space, according to the New Testament? See, the New Testament describes believers as the temple. It describes believers as the temple because Jesus referred to his body as the temple, and we are the body of Christ. The New Testament says that the Spirit of God, the same glory of God of the Old Testament, quote, tabernacles within us. We are sacred space. This is why Paul in 2 Corinthians 6 would say things like, what fellowship does the temple of God have with idols? You know, don't you recognize that you're the temple of God? You know, all this impurity, you know, language like in 2 Corinthians 6, okay? This is why the New Testament talks about us the way it does. We are sacred space. So if that's true in the New Testament era, and it is because that's what the New Testament says, why do we need to build a building and then regularly decontaminate it? Why do we need to do that? Again, I don't see the coherence and the consistency. Why would we revert to purifying sacred space on the ground in a building so that we can be in the presence of God, when the presence of God, the Spirit of God, is in us? What? In the millennium, believers are no longer inhabited by the Spirit? Is that the point? Again, people rarely think about the ramifications of the literalist approach to this. And again, aren't there any Bibles in the millennium? Doesn't the Spirit of God reside inside believers, tabernacle within them in the millennium, making them sacred space? Why do we need this? These assumptions need to be evaluated. These questions need to be asked. Again, and I've asked them to myself a good amount, and which is why I gravitate away from looking at Ezekiel 40 through 48 as some sort of command or even vision of something that's going to have to be built later on. Now, the second issue, let's just transition away from that. Those are my arguments, my negative arguments against the literalistic approach. But our second issue for today concerns the matter of the Nasi, okay, the prince that is talked about in these chapters. Now, I could have included this as a problem for literalism as well, but I don't want to do that because this is less familiar, and we need to... It sort of needs to have its own space, its own time, its own dedicated treatment here. So that's the way we're going to handle it. And I associate it with literalism because you're going to see that if you take what's said about the prince too literally, you're actually going to have disconnections between that figure, that character, and Jesus, the returned Messiah. So it could be another one of those issues where, hey, who's the consistent literalist here? You know, if you want to take these chapters and talk about the temple, then you need to be consistent and look at the prince with the same commitment to literalism. If you do that, you're just going to run into problems. But that's not to say that he has no connection at all to Messiah, because there might be, there could be that sort of thing, maybe conceptually, maybe a little bit. But if you're really pressing the text for literalism, it's not good enough to have a little bit of a correlation between Jesus and the prince. You need all of it. Now, I realize that talk is probably unfamiliar totally, because most people, when they read these chapters, they are fixated only on the building description. They kind of gloss over this prince guy in these chapters, but we need to get into that. So the starting point for this is to note, first off, you know, full disclosure here, because we're dealing with a text, that the word nasi, prince, is of course not the same as the word for king, melech, but elsewhere in Ezekiel, those two terms appear synonymous. They do overlap. And for that reason, scholars fall into sort of two interpretive categories when it comes to this figure, the prince. Number one is that the nasi, the prince, is also the king, Melech, and probably of the house of David. So there's one school of thought that says the prince is a Davidic king that gets referred to also as king and you know, as prince here in these chapters, just like in Ezekiel 33 through 37, where there are passages where these two terms overlap. We should take that information, and when we read Ezekiel 40 through 48, we think to ourselves, even though he's only called prince here, nasi, we're still talking about a Davidic king. So that's the first view. The second view is to say, well, the nasi, the prince, is not a Davidic king, and he's not a Davidic king because at this point in Israel's history, they've sort of despaired of having the monarchy return. They've despaired of a messianic hope. Again, this is sort of a standard critical view, or at least you don't have a king specifically in view here. That's not really a good argument because, again, I think it's a little bit of an odd hermeneutic to say that the Jews have abandoned a messianic hope here, because you're going to have prophecy at the same time period outside of Ezekiel, and you're going to have prophecy after the time of Ezekiel that is clearly looking for a future messianic rule. So I think that's kind of an odd approach. I think better for the second view that we don't have a Davidic king here. We don't have a specific Messiah figure. I think better is to note that there are specific restrictions in these chapters placed on the Nasi that make his identification as the Messiah extremely unlikely, and some would say impossible. Okay, so those are the two views. One, you know, take you know, who cares if he's the prince? He's called the prince. He's still the king because those two terms overlap. We have a messianic figure here. Okay, that's one view. The other view that I'll adopt for the sake of our episode is like, no, we can't really look at this Nasi figure as a prince, as the Messiah, because there's just too many restrictions placed on him that don't jive with Messiah in general, and frankly, don't jive with Jesus. Okay? And I'm going to fall into the second view. I think you can already tell that. Now, I'm going to quote at length here from an article by a scholar whose last name is Biggs. His first name escapes me right now. I think it's Robert, but I don't want to commit to that. And I will put this article in the folder, the protected folder, for those who subscribe to the newsletter, so you can read it if you want. But it's called The Role of Nasi in the Program of Restoration in Ezekiel 40 through 48. And Biggs writes this. I like this because, I frankly, I could not improve on a better summary of this. And I'm really going to skip around a number of pages here and mash this together, different sections of his article. But it's a nice summary of what we're dealing with here. He writes, the term Nasi occurs 18 times in chapters 40 through 48, all in chapters 43 to 48, and is the only title used for the leader of the future restored community. Now catch that. It's the only title used for the leader of the future restored community in these chapters. Continuing, by way of comparison, Melech, king, occurs 3 times, all in the brief passage, Ezekiel 43, 6 through 9, and all referring to past kings of Judah. The references to Nasi in chapters 43 to 48 are concerned with the Nasi's relationship to the temple or the distribution of the land. It may be that the latter use also has some connection with the temple. The first reference to the Nasi occurs in Ezekiel 44, verse 3. This verse prescribes that only the Nasi may sit in the east gate of the temple and eat bread before Yahweh. The east gate is permanently closed because the, quote, glory of Yahweh, unquote, has entered the temple through it. The Nasi is permitted to eat a sacrificial meal in the gate, and it thus becomes something of a cult room, as other scholars say. But the Nasi is not given any cult functions here or elsewhere. I should stop here and say the term cult in scholarly lingo is to be equated with doing rituals. Okay, back to Biggs. The role of the Nasi in relation to the cult, again, the ritual character of the priesthood here, is taken up in chapters 45, 46. Okay. And he has some verse citations there. Chapter 45, verses 13 through 15 describes the atonement offering to be made by the people. This offering is to be given to the Nasi. This gives the Nasi an important role in the cult. He is not directly involved in making the offerings and sacrifices, but he is responsible for providing the animals and grain so that offerings may be made for the house of Israel. As in chapter 44, verse 3, we see the Nasi closely related to the cultic activity, though not actually involved in it. However, in a real sense, responsibility for its proper functioning falls to him. Provision for the celebration of the Passover festival and the Feast of Ingathering are given in chapter 45. We notice that the provisions for the sacrifices are to be made by the Nasi, quote, for himself and for the people of the land. I note that, for himself and for the people of the land. That is, the Nasi is responsible for the effective functioning of these festivals. He is not directly involved in the actual sacrificial action, but he is to ensure that that action may take place. He is not a cultic official, but he supports the operation of the cult. The Nasi is of primary interest in chapter 46, 1 through 12, but he is considered in relation to the people when regulations for movement within the temple are given. Verses 1 through 8 deal with his honored position in the cultic celebration. He may stand at the threshold of the inner east gate when it is open for sacrifice on the Sabbaths and new moon celebrations. He is not permitted into the inner court itself, but at the entrance he may observe his sacrifices being offered. The position of the Nasi and the people in the temple is taken up again in verses 9 through 10. The specific mention of the Nasi going into the temple with the people and going out with them suggests some form of procession. Other references to the Nasi relate to the position of his land in the allocation among the tribes. Now this you need to pay attention to. The first of these is concerned with the distribution of the land for the temple, the priests, and the Levites, and also the city, and the Nasi. So that's chapters 46, I believe. He actually has verses 1 through 5, 6, and verses 7 and 8, but he gives a number of chapters, so you have to look those up. But the Nasi, again, gets particular land, so that's the point here. Back to Biggs. There is no mention of the distribution to the tribes in this account. It is rather concerned with those institutions which relate to all the tribes. To that extent, the Nasi is seen in relation to the temple, along with the priests and Levites, but separated from the temple by the priests. This allocation of land appears to give geographical expression to the position of the Nasi. He is near the center of importance, but he is not the center of importance. That position, geographically, is taken by the temple. Next to the temple are the priests with the Nasi next to them. What may we conclude from this discussion? First, now catch these statements here. First, the position held by the Nasi is one of honor, as his place in the temple shows. He is the only one who may eat bread before Yahweh in the east gate and make his offerings in the gate. Also, he is given an area of land which is separate from the tribes. It is central and near the area set apart from the temple, priests, and Levites, and the city. Second, although not a priest or Levite, and therefore not permitted to offer sacrifice or serve in the temple, the Nasi has an important place in the functioning of the cult. He is to provide or to ensure that provision is made for the sacrifices. Third, as noted in the first point, the Nasi is given an area of land on either side of that set apart for the temple, priests, and Levites, and the city. Apart from the honor and importance which this confers on him, there are three important conclusions to be drawn. Biggs lists these out. One, the Nasi is given independence. He has land for his support. I would ask here, and I'm going to break in here to Biggs, what does the Messiah need with support? Okay. He will not need, back to Biggs, he will not need to depend on taxes or other means of support from the temple or from the people. Number two, the Nasi is forbidden to attempt to extend his land by taking that which is allotted to other tribes. He is also directed away from the pattern of earlier rulers who oppressed the people and pointed toward the promotion of justice and righteousness. Third, he is not permitted to dispose of his land allocation. It has to remain the possession of his family. Now, that reference to the family ought to be interesting. I would say this is back, you know, sort of the way we summarize this. Here's the point to all of this. If you are literalizing the passage, okay, And again, my argument is going to be, if you're reading Ezekiel 40 through 48 and you're insisting on literalism for the building, then you need to insist on literalism for the prince. And if you're identifying with him with the Messiah, with Jesus, you got some problems here. Here's why. If you're doing this, here are the problems. Number one, why would Jesus be supervising a sacrificial system? That's the role of the Nicene. He doesn't do any of the rituals, but he's in charge of making it happen. Why would Jesus be doing that? Again, consider the problems of the absent furniture here, where do they wash, and of course, the whole thing concept about bringing back sacrifices. Now you're putting Jesus in charge of a system that was rendered obsolete by what he did on the cross. Okay, it just seems like it's severely disconnected here. Number two, here's your second problem. Since Messiah is also a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, it seems totally incoherent that parts of the cult and the temple complex would be off limits to him. But that's what you have. If the Nasi here is the returned Messiah, that's what you have. Again, just doesn't work. Third, does the returned Christ have a wife and children, physical descendants? After all, the Nasi is forbidden to get rid of his land. It has to stay within his family. So how does that work? Four, how is it that the king of all the earth, in the form of the returned Christ, has restrictions on what land he can hold? Five, how is it that the messianic king has no political tasks? How does a non-political Messiah rule the nations with the rod of iron? Sixth and last, choosing to take the prince talk non-literally, but the temple talk literally is, to say the least, interpretively inconsistent. But if that's what you want to do, then, you know, that's what you're going to do. What I'm saying is, and what we've covered in this episode, is there are negative arguments against a literalistic approach, viewing what Ezekiel is describing here, viewing the fruition or the fulfillment of it as a temple that's in operation during the millennium. It's very, very problematic, both for those negative reasons, and also, if you're going to do that, then what about the prince? Are you going to take him literally too? Is this prince, again, a messianic figure, again, associated with David? Because after all, prince and king are interchangeable in other chapters in Ezekiel. It seems like we should do that. Well, if we do that, and if we press the literalism, we've got significant problems here. Again, things that just don't line up with the description of the returned Messiah. So, again, where does this leave us? I would say, if on the other hand, you abstract the talk about the temple. Again, you make it conceptual, symbolic, you know, something like that. If you think about it abstractly, and in the temple's case, you know, we get the benefit of having New Testament temple talk, which is where we're going to focus next week. But if you abstract the temple talk, if you abstract the prince talk, in other words, you get away from rigid literalism, then you can sort of make some sense of this, and you can kind of make it work with a Davidic ruler. Now, here's what Biggs does. And again, I don't know where Biggs is at theologically, but he argues for a Davidic ruler who isn't a king or a priest. So I'm just going to use this for illustration. Obviously, the returned Messiah is both a king and a priest. But here's what Biggs, you know, does with this. He says the emphasis here is on the Nasi as a leader rather than a ruler. That is, there is an intentional distinction between the leader of the new community, whose significance is to be seen in relation to the temple, and the pre-exilic rulers whose significance was seen in their political activity, which led to compromises in the religious life of the people. Also, as a political figure, the king offered hope for the people because he was of the house of David and therefore heir to the promise of David. In the new community, that hope is to be found in the temple, in other words, not in a Messiah, which offers the people the way to Yahweh, who is the source of their peace and prosperity. The Nasi is still a significant figure as he enables the temple to perform its function by ensuring the requirements for sacrifice and celebration are present. Okay, so end of quote. What Biggs is saying, and a lot of scholars are here with this, is that, look, by this time they'd given up on the Messiah idea. They'd given up on the monarchy, but the temple gave them hope. The temple, you know, said to them that God, we can still worship God, we can still be acceptable to God. Again, it becomes very works-oriented, which, you know, this is Judaism for its time period. And so what else can they do? You know, what else can they do? You know, and of course, Jesus, you know, when he comes the first time around, challenges this whole notion. And I think, quite honestly, I think this is why when he in the temple scene, you know, when Jesus, you know, chases out the money changers. And he's like, look, destroy this temple. In 3 days, I'll build it up. And the account is very clear that he's not referring to the structure. He's referring to himself. The body of Christ is the temple. In that conversation, the body of Christ is transformed, or transforms the temple language. If you look at that, well, then you're going a whole different direction away from literalism. And frankly, the New Testament does go that direction. I find it extraordinarily difficult to defend a literal temple view. So, you know, I think we need to start thinking on these terms. If we abstract these things, we can have this work because we allow the New Testament to tell us how to read this language. We're not tied up by bringing back the sacrifices. We're not tied up by explaining the inconsistencies and the disconnections of the temple description in Ezekiel just on their own terms. We went through you know, the list of them here in this episode and in relationship to descriptions of building the tabernacle and the first temple. We're not bound to worry about that and explain it if we let the New Testament temple talk essentially just take over at this point. We're also not bound and tied up and hemmed in and concerned with explaining, well, now wait a minute. Okay, so in the millennium, we have the Messiah, but then he hires this other guy who's also a Davidic ruler, but he's not a king and he's not a priest either. He just supervises the sacrifices that come back. What? Okay. You know, we don't have to worry about coming up with some way to make that picture coherent. You do have to worry about all that stuff if you press the literalism. So in part two, you know, next week, we're going to talk about really what I think is a better approach. You know, I've already telegraphed that I'm on the non-literal side of this. I would refer to it as the transcendent side of this, the transcendent reality view, not just, you know, worrying about a building. And let me just give you a little preview of how we're going to approach this next week. There are positive arguments for taking the vision as more than literal, as transcending a building. Number one, Ezekiel 48, the rearrangement of the tribes, there's an issue there that is going to, again, suggest something. So I'll just leave it there. Number two, there are strong links in Ezekiel 40 through 48 to the Eden story and the cosmic mountain idea. Chapter 40, verse 2, very high mountain Zion. Well, if you've actually ever been there, it's really not that high. It's not even the highest mountain in the area. But that language is cosmic mountain language. That means it's the most important mountain. It's the one that is the focus of God. Okay, it gets elevated, pun intended, to high status because it's His domain. Again, this is cosmic mountain talk. If you're familiar with Unseen Realm, you're familiar with the concept of the cosmic mountain. You know, I'll throw in another one. In Ezekiel 47, the water and its effect. Taylor makes the comment that the land, and in particular, the barren wilderness of the Arava and the Dead Sea, are in view in Ezekiel 47, and they are transformed into an Edenic description. I think that's intentional. I think that speaks of something more than a building. Again, it's this transcendent idea. This is the restored Eden. And the restored Eden, if you peek, just take a peek. Go to Revelation 21 and 22. It says there was no temple. Okay, when the new Eden comes to earth, when we have a global Eden transformed, John point blank says when the city descends, okay, that Zion, okay, on there, right there, on the mountain, the whole cosmic idea, the city descends, this is where God lives, it's the cosmic mountain thing. When that happens, there is no temple. I saw no temple there because you didn't need one because God was the source of light. Okay, so what I'm suggesting to you again is start thinking more abstractly, you know, this sort of stuff. Third, there's the issue of New Testament temple talk. Again, we got into that a little bit, but we're going to return to that in some more detail later on. An interesting tidbit here, okay? And I'm going to go back to Greenberg here. And actually, this isn't Greenberg. This is Bergsma. And maybe I will put this article in the folder when we do part two. But catch this statement. This is from an article by Bergsma called "The Restored Temple as Rebuilt Jubilee." I'm sure some of your boats are already floating just at the title of that article, but listen to this. In this article, Bergsma says at one point, mention of the destruction of the city, Jerusalem. This is, he's commenting on chapters 40 through 43 here. mention of the destruction of the city in Jerusalem in the opening date formula in Ezekiel 40, verse 1. That's the way this whole section begins. Presages the antithesis between the following vision, okay, all this temple stuff, and the awful event it was meant to remedy. Was the date significant? We know of no event in the year 25 of the exile, 571 BC calculated, with which to connect this vision. But 25 years is half a jubilee, and the year of release is mentioned in Ezekiel 46:17. And the number and its double, 50, and the multiples thereof, 100, 500, 5,000, 10,000, 25,000, recur ahead in the measurements of the temple and the land. Okay, I'll stop there. Here's the question. Is that a coincidence? Or does it mean something? Is it designed to draw our attention to the Jubilee? And if it's designed to draw our attention abstractly to the concept of Jubilee, then what we have in Ezekiel 40 through 48 is a marriage of cosmic mountain stuff and Jubilee stuff. Could that be the point? Now, I'm going to suggest to you that makes good sense, but it's sure not literalism. And you know what? We need to get away from this notion that non-literal means not real. I would suggest to you when the Lord returns, and if the Jubilee thing is how we should read Ezekiel 40 through 48, it's still real. These are still real-time events. They're just described in symbolic language. Symbolic language does not mean what's being described will not happen. What's being described is not real. What's being described can be dismissed. No, that is a caricature of non-literal interpretive approach. It's a caricature, which is another way of saying it's bogus, okay? It's a straw man. So I hope that that sort of gives you a little taste, you know, a little foretaste of what we're going to get into next time. It's a very interesting possibility. Again, we're going to be dipping back into Bergsma, this whole Jubilee idea. Again, just taking an altogether different approach in part two. And I'm telegraphing you up front that I'm in the non-literal camp here. I don't know that Bergsma's right or anybody else is right. I think the New Testament's right, okay? I think the New Testament drives us in this direction as well as the problems we talked about today. But I'm not going to claim to have everything nailed down. I just want you to consider a different approach next time in part two.
Now, the temple is a big part of the Jewish eschatology. Could mm-hmm. you touch on that a little bit?
I actually think that let's say they started building a temple tomorrow, I'm willing to bet my library. Okay. So, you know, I'm pretty serious here. I'm willing to bet my library it won't match Ezekiel 40 through 48. In other words, if people start building a temple even now, because if that starts happening, you know what people are going to say, oh, this is fulfillment of prophecy. Oh, we got the end times right upon us. And yeah, okay, let's just see what they actually build. And if it's not, if it doesn't conform to Ezekiel 40 through 48, you're going to have people somehow try to explain that again. Oh, well, this one has to be destroyed. Then we'll get the real millennial time. The whole question is just going to churn up again. It's just going to change directions a little bit. It'll become what it was. I think, you know, in view of just Judaism, any serious Jew would love to see a temple. Okay, they would love to see this. Now, here's the question. In view of what we talked about today, but let's say that the Jews have rebuilt their temple. There it is. Somehow they pulled this off without causing a third world war. Are they going to look at that as the fulfillment of prophecy? You say, well, what prophecy? You could say on one hand, well, they might look here at Ezekiel 40 through 48 and say, okay, you know, we couldn't build one that big and we put a roof on it. Okay. So it's not the same, but that's okay because this is going to help us worship God. It's going to be, you know, part of what we need to get back to. But you know what? To really have Israel restored, we do need a Davidic king. We do need all of the land. And of course, then they're going to have to fight about what the promised land really is, the boundaries of it. In other words, they could have a temple today, but do they have the other things? And who needs those other things to be satisfied that they're looking at some sort of act of God in a prophetic sense? You're going to have other Jews that say, hey, it doesn't matter. after all, Ezekiel 40 through 48, there's this prince guy. We're just going to hire some guy. It pays well. It has benefits. You know, okay, we're just going to hire some guy and he'll supervise a new sacrificial system. And we're content to not, you know, worry about, you know, starting a war here that the Messiah can win and settle. And we're just grateful to have a temple. This is good enough. I mean, you're going to have a whole spectrum of opinion on, is this prophetic fulfillment? Does this have anything to do at all with prophecy? Does it have something to do with prophecy and we're going to be content? Or is this like the first installment of other prophecies? You're not going to have unanimity in thought on any of this, even if you built one today. You're just not. The only way you're going to have tongues really wagging is building exactly what Ezekiel describes. But see, then what's still missing? What is missing? The Davidic ruler. Even like a number two guy that's not the Messiah and he's not like this guy we talked about today in Ezekiel 40 through 48. You know, even if you hired that guy or found that guy, what authority does he really have? Is he just a figurehead? We don't have a theocracy still. We don't have a Davidic ruler. Aren't we supposed to get that? Or have we given up on Messiah? Have we given up on the land and we're satisfied now with just having this temple? Is that where we're at now, and that's where we're going to be? A lot of Jews would say, good enough, close enough, horseshoes and hand grenades, okay, good enough. But you're going to have others that say, no, it's not good enough. It's not good enough until it conforms exactly to Ezekiel 40 through 48, until we have every last square inch of the land God promised to us, and until we have a Davidic king ruling not only here, but we can read the last few chapters in Isaiah too. He's supposed to rule the world. That's good enough. People just don't get into the ramifications of what they're talking about when it comes to this sort of material.
And I'll admit, Mike, I've always believed in literalism for the temple, so I'm going to have to go and digest that. But what I do know, Mike, I can help people out here, is that the Cosmic Mountain is not Space Mountain at Walt Disney World. So... if anybody was confusing the two, I just want to go ahead.
I'm sure glad you pointed that out.
Help people out that might be confused.
I rode that thing all the time. You know, we used to go to Disney World when I was in junior high. We'd go late. We just keep getting on that thing.
There you go.
Well, see, the Lord was preparing me to talk about the Cosmic Mountain there when I was getting whipped around like an idiot.
Well, there you go, Mike. Well, one more to go and we will be done with Ezekiel. And Mike, I just wanted to mention that I was
thinking. Are you going
to
cry, Trey?
No.
You're going to break into tears here.
But it's taken almost a year. So we should have a rap party or something like they do with movies and whatnot, because it's a long book.
It is a long book. Yeah.
And I'm hoping.
Yeah, we're going to have some kind of vote, right? I can't remember when, you know, because we've talked about that, about what's next. So
Yeah. And it's coming up here in probably in June. We'll let them vote for the whole month. And we've got two books in the New Testament, one book in the Old Testament, and the two books in the New Testament are a little bit shorter. So I'm hoping that they'll go New Testament this time rather than back into another long Old Testament.
See, what we should have done was we should not have done Obadiah, so that at this point we could say, okay, it's two New Testament, then Obadiah. Then
we could do like Jude or something. Yeah. And it's only one chapter. That's low hanging fruit. You want to do something like that? That's one episode, probably.
That's still ringing in my head from the last Q&A, so probably not.
No? Okay. All right. Well, I want to bring up something else that's funny, but I was looking at our Facebook group, and Deborah posted a funny jib-jab dancing video of us dancing as chickens.
Oh, so come on. What do you mean, us?
Well, do you know what jib-jab is? You can make little videos, and you can insert somebody's, like, head.
Somebody's face.
Picture of their face.
Oh, and wonderful.
Have them dancing.
I know what I'm not watching later today. So,
but it's funny. So I told Deborah and them in our Facebook group that I'd give them a shout out for that video. So if you have not liked our Naked Bible podcast.
Your friend or an enemy?
No, it's good. It's funny. she said it's good. You need to go watch it. Everybody go watch it. If you're not part of the Facebook group, the Naked Bible group on Facebook, go join it. All right. Well, with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening. The Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.